Hey folks, I'm Dr. Amy Perlman. I'm coming at you from the AUA in Washington, D.C. with my partner in podcast, Dr. Larry Lipschultz.
Now you have to clarify partner in podcast, yeah. Or that's the wrong message.
Why?
This is going to go out there. Anyway, pleasure being here.
Yeah. And we have Dr. Nick Diebel with us today. Nick, say hello to the crew.
Hi, crew. My name is Dr. Diebel. I'm at Northwestern University, andrology fellow there.
Awesome. And where are you going after your fellowship
ends? So I'm headed down to the Gulf Coast. Mm-hmm. I'll be at University of South Alabama, mm-hmm. in Mobile, Alabama, starting men's health practice there.
So where did you grow up?
So I'm originally from Hershey, Pennsylvania. Grew up all around Hershey Med and then just moved progressively.
That's Penn State.
Yep.
Yeah. I've been to the Hershey Museum.
Progressively have just moved south ever since. So did my medical school in Virginia and then trained at Wake Forest in North Carolina and then short stint to the Midwest and back down south.
That's where I initially met you when you were about to start your residency at Wake Forest. So let me ask you this. You know, we put so much time, money, effort, and resources when it comes to our training. And then once we're done with training and someone says, oh, where do you want to work for your first like big girl or big boy job?
Yeah.
How do you decide to take a job in Alabama?
Gosh, there's just so many different things that go into choosing a job. And for me, one, my wife lives in Florida, so we're about 6 hours, or is from Florida, so we're about 6 hours away. But for me, you know, I have an incredibly supportive partner who, you know, pushed me to pursue a job that makes me happy. And for me, I really wanted to choose an academic position where I could be involved in research, working with trainees. And, you know, for me, I really wanted to start a program from the ground up. So I'm the first person at my program doing men's health and fertility. So for me, that was a big deal.
Why don't you tell us a little bit, because that's a new urology department or new
medical school? The urology department is about 10 years old.
Yeah.
We do have a residency.
How many residents?
So we're one a year until we graduate our first resident, which will be next year. Mm-hmm.
You elect to go to a fledgling program?
Yeah.
Instead of, because I'm sure you had other job offers.
Sure, of course. Yeah.
Was it because they didn't have anything and you wanted to create?
It was. You know, for me, I really enjoy the full spectrum of my fellowship, which is obviously everything ranging from ED to Peyronie's to hormonal management to fertility. And I went on many job interviews where, you know, they were searching for one of those pieces, right? They want a fertility person, but they already have three penile implanters or they already have a Peyronie's expert. And for me, I just really enjoy the whole continuum of men's health care. So I really wanted to be able to do all of that at my job.
Yeah, it's very unusual to be able to find a position
where you could be
the beginning of a new program.
Very hard.
And then you can always specialize in, let's say, one of those aspects later on in your career.
But
the time to not be so niche is when you first start out.
Right, and I think that's the goal. I mean, certainly, Dr. Lipschultz, you've done this within your career, but, you know, start broad, find what you're passionate about, build the program, and successful programs are programs that have multiple people, right, who subspecialize within the subspecialty. So that is the long-term goal.
But I think that the problem, as I see it, is going to be all the ancillary stuff you need
for sure
to be successful. So you're going to have to look into ultrasound and establishing, are you going to have your own lab?
Yes. So
clinical and research?
Yeah. So from a research perspective, there are partnered University of South Alabama PhD researchers that I will be partnering with. So that's that proportion of it. My situation is a little unique in that we do not have a specific university REI group. However, there are many different private groups in town. They're within 10, 15 minutes of me. Some of them are adjunctive faculty to the university. So we will, by extension, use their andrology lab. But I do also have, you know, when I negotiated my contract, I do have funding to build our own lab.
I mean, I would definitely recommend getting your own lab because you don't want to be beholden to someone down the street. Especially if you don't like something and you want to change it.
Of course.
You know, they're not going to listen to you.
You lose some freedom to do what you want.
Yeah.
And you had mentioned that, right? You'd mentioned that to me. You're like, if I'm going to give you one piece of advice, it's, you know, have your own lab.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you talk more about why that's important?
Well, for many reasons. Yeah. First of all, by having your own lab.
In the infertility
space. Yes. Yeah. By having your own lab, you do have quality control. You can control, you can check things out, make sure things are going the way you want them. And secondly, you could be innovative. You know, we can start doing DNA fragmentation assay in-house. We started our own sperm bank in-house.
Absolutely.
And if you're beholden to someone down the street in an IVF program, their interest may not be your interests.
Correct.
So, you know, and I also think you have a great ability to train other people to, if you are going to have a fellowship, you know, they learn how to do things in the lab because it's right there. Yeah. It's literally 10 feet away. So I think in our space, in reproductive medicine, a lab, I think, is essential. Now, I was very fortunate. I had Dr. Dory Lamb, who came in and had the best lab in the United States. So, I mean, you know, but she was over in the medical school. In our clinical side, we had a separate CLIA lab. That's another thing, CLIA certification. It's hard. You're going to have to do that. You're going to have to get somebody to run your lab.
Yep. You need an HCLD and you need somebody who has those qualifications.
Yeah.
So in the research world, I want to expand our discussion a little bit. And a lot of patients are asking us about Botox, and not necessarily for the face, but for the genitals.
Yes.
So you guys, or you helped come up with a study looking at Botox for men.
Yes.
Tell us more.
So certainly Botox for, you know, genital urinary appearance in men has been around for a while. So you hear people talk about like Scrotox and things like that. That's more cosmetic. The study that we're doing is a pilot randomized crossover trial at Northwestern. This is functional. So this is for erectile dysfunction. Mm-hmm. There are a few studies on this already. They're all out of France and other areas in Europe.
So what's the hypothesis?
So the hypothesis is that we're administering, and it's Xeomin is the specific formulation. This is Incobotulinum toxin A. It's a purified toxin relative to like your typical, when you hear Botox, there's, you know, more proteins associated with that. So we went with a pure form for research purposes. Nice, clean for the design. And the hypothesis is that in men with mild to moderate erectile dysfunction, we're going to see a minimally clinically important difference. So we all know MCID for erectile function, you know, depending on what stage you are, there's a certain point increase we expect to see for men to, you know, leave the office and say, wow, that made a difference for me. And we expect for guys with mild ED or moderate ED that they will reach that with intracavernosal.
But what's the hypothesis? You're going to dilate arteries?
So the proposed mechanism of action, which has been cited, is that, as we all know, because we use Botox in many areas of urology, Botox cleaves the snare complex, which prevents the release of, you know, sympathetic neurotransmitters, right? So norepinephrine, epinephrine. So essentially, this is what has been deemed in the literature a sympathectomy type of deal. So by doing this, we are preventing the release of sympathetic tone in the penis. And what has also been shown in the lab is that the release of nitric oxide from parasympathetic side is independent of the snare complex. So by downregulating or inhibiting the snare complex, we are decreasing sympathetic tone, and we are preserving, and there's also been some data in animal labs and things like that show increased nitric oxide. So we're kind of downregulating sympathetic tone, increasing parasympathetic tone. And then we're also coupling this with tadalafil.
So the hope is increased penile blood flow.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's the hypothesis, that the use of Botox will increase penile blood flow. Yeah. So you're going to do a duplex before, a duplex during, after, whatever.
Yeah, so we do have that planned as part of this study. And certainly the literature existing does show that we see changes in duplex studies when we administer this drug.
You should speak to the gentleman we spoke to with the metric for measuring
penile tumescence.
Yes, and we do have some of those things planned.
That would be very, very exciting.
They do have a study ongoing with that group from France.
And then you can segue to the clitoris.
Yes.
Right?
Well, I think this is very interesting
because you didn't say anything.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, a lot of the medications we use in women can be used off-label in men and vice versa. And I think that actually brings people together. This is not like a male disease or a female disease or a male treatment versus a female treatment. Oftentimes, that can also bring a couple together, you know, rather than coming from a place of deficiency. It's like, hey, babe, I'm going to do this medication. Why don't we do it together? And we can both have a better experience.
Right. Absolutely.
But I love what you guys are doing with this Botox study, because the reality is, as urologists, it's a very polarizing topic. We've seen, you know, on the different panels, the pro, the con approach. The reality is, guys are coming in, the dudes are coming into our clinic, they're asking about Botox.
The dudes
are coming in, they're, you know, coming into our clinic, and they're asking about these novel therapeutics, right? And so we have to be on the forefront in terms of studying them. Otherwise, other people are going to do it. There's not going to be any research or safety data.
Are people injecting Botox?
Not, I mean,
in the community, people are doing it.
I mean, it's being done
I've done it for penile retraction. I've used it off-label for that.
Right,
and I'll tell you.
That's a altogether different bag because you're talking about relaxing.
Right, right.
And he's talking about the
breast. This is intracavernous.
Yeah. But I've done it.
But is anybody else doing it now in the community, just injecting it into the penis?
Not that I'm aware of in the Chicago.
I will bet you.
But somebody
probably is. Though, for a gentleman.
Somebody probably is.
For ED?
Well, he wasn't really having erectile dysfunction, but he wanted it in both places. I injected it like into dartos and intracavernosally. I didn't do his cheeks at all. But you know, the honest thing is, I have a very honest conversation with patients. I tell them, look, there's very limited research. We know that Botox in general is a very safe medication.
Of course.
It may or may not help you. I don't oversell anything. Sure. And for some guys, they're willing to say, I'm willing to try it.
The good thing about Botox is that you can reverse it.
Well, I mean, you can't reverse Botox. I mean, Botox goes away in the body.
That's what I mean.
It
goes away.
Of course,
and that is variable in everyone. I mean, hyaluronic acid with the filler is something we can reverse. But it tends to be a safe medication. And I would say that's one of the biggest advantages.
Yeah, the studies that have been published to date have showed no serious adverse events. The only adverse event that's been reported is penile pain associated with the injection.
So there have been human studies.
There have, yeah.
And where are they out of?
They're out of France. Yes. And major limitations to those studies, kudos to them for starting this work. Mm-hmm. But those studies included radical prostatectomy patients. They included patients with spinal cord injury, severe diabetes.
Right.
So we're doing a very
organic disease than your guys.
We're doing a very refined, controlled population.
But you're using a special type of Botox. You're using the very pure
botulinum.
Yes, it's called Xeomin, which is made by Merz Pharmaceuticals. But yes, which we have a grant.
So you went to industry and they're going to support it.
Yep.
See?
I love that.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
See, we need industry or things don't move.
This was an investigator-initiated grant that I started the application for about a year ago. Mm-hmm. Just got granted about 6 months ago, and now we're up on clinical trials.
Are you going to take it with you or are they going to leave
it
there?
I
want to take it with me.
Well, you know,
how could you not take it with
you?
So
we started this so long ago at the beginning of my fellowship. And to be honest, this is I've been a part of clinical trials before, but this is my first one that like was my baby,
right?
You know, and I severely underestimated how much time it would take to get this up and running.
Right.
We unfortunately at Northwestern, we have a wonderful clinical trial team. However, we did have some change in personnel within the clinical trial leadership team. And there was a couple months of delay with getting things up and running because the recruitment goal is small because it's a crossover study.
But
it's a pilot
study. Who went to the pharmaceutical company?
Me.
Well, then why can't you take it with you? I don't understand.
Well,
that.
Look, he's got his cut out for him starting out at his new job.
So here's my make him famous.
So here's my goal with this is that because, I mean, the grant is in my name.
Right.
We're going to keep it. We're going to do the pilot study, which initially we had talked about doing this as a multi-center study among, you know, high volume people across the country.
Centers.
And what the industry came back and said is we would like to see a pilot study first in the United States, single center. And then if we show some efficacy, I will be open. I'm eligible for a much larger grant, which will transition to me as a multi.
Now, can you go to SBIR grant for this, or because it's a farm company?
I don't believe so.
I think
but
you can.
I have to look into it.
But I would definitely look into that.
Yeah,
because you know they're looking for funding things to fund.
Okay.
So let me ask you this. If someone is interested and they're watching, where can they find out more once you all start enrolling?
Absolutely. So it will be published on our website. It's, you know, there's going to be.
See, this is our.
Now, Northwestern Medicine. I am leaving Northwestern, but we have four full-time faculty andrology attendings at Northwestern who are all recruiting for this. And certainly they can contact our department to register for this trial.
We hope there'll be some big news next year.
I hope so.
Yeah, we'll have to stay tuned for AUA 2027.
It's a six-month crossover, so it'll take, you know, a year for the patients to, you know, mature the data. But
you'll have some signals.
We will. And we'll have an interim analysis.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Nick, good to see
you.
Likewise. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.